You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, Episode 12, Patrick, Brent, Worf, and Laverne. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. Star Trek Las Vegas 2011 is in the history books, but for those of you who couldn't be there, we have TrekNews.net's Brian Wilkins with us today to give a recap of what happened at the con. And then, in the feature, we'll discuss the good, the bad, and the just plain weird of the last of the TNG films, Nemesis. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It looks like the sun's finally coming out. We're having some good weather, some cool weather. Finally getting out of this terrible, terrible summer heat wave we've had. What about you?
Yeah, I'll be glad when it's over. I heard there was a horda at Star Trek Las Vegas, and I think it wandered in from here because I've seen quite a few of them around here. Oh, boy. You know, speaking of Star Trek Las Vegas, that was the big thing last week, and I was really disappointed that we couldn't be there this year, and I think I'm actually just kind of just now recovering from my sadness, and as some of our friends on Twitter have begun to go back home from Las Vegas, I'm no longer being reminded that I'm not there.
Yeah, there's pretty much every 5 minutes I'd see some new tweet of something I wanted to see at Las Vegas and I couldn't see. I was glad that I'm living on the opposite side of the world, and so I could sleep through some of the Las Vegas tweets because it was just making me feel really sad.
Yeah, those were bad enough. And then the ones like, hey, we're having a drink. We wish you were here. That wasn't helping out very much either. But, in lieu of our usual news segment this week, we have a nice little thing to help us recover from not being at Star Trek Las Vegas. This week, we have Brian Wilkins from TrekNews.net with us, and he's going to be taking us through everything that happened at Star Trek Las Vegas. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Greg. Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome.
So, Brian, I don't even know where to start on Star Trek Las Vegas. I was watching the news from here in Japan, and there was just so much going on. So why don't you just jump in and give us a little firsthand account of the experience, and then we'll hit on some of the real specifics of what was going on there.
Chris, it was a whirlwind 4 days. We left Southern California on Thursday morning so we could get there in time for Garrett Wong. So he appeared on Thursday. The main event of Thursday was Dominic Keating and Connor Trinneer talking Enterprise, talked about how it was cut short, how they wished it hadn't been cut short. There was a ton going on Thursday, as well as we threw a little party over at one of the bars inside the Rio. The convention moved to the Rio this year. It was previously over at the Las Vegas Hilton.
And how is the Rio compared to the Hilton? I assume you've been to Star Trek Las Vegas when it was in the Hilton sometimes over the years as well, right?
Yeah, I've been going to it for, I've been going to the convention now for a few years. And, it gets better and better and better every year. And I don't mean to, be blowing sunshine, but it really does. From the friendships that you make going there and the experiences that you have, it's, it's like no other. It was fantastic. And moving over to the Rio took a little getting used to. But, everyone that I spoke to a bunch of fans so we could report on it on over at TrekNews.net. And everyone seemed to really enjoy it. It's a larger hotel. There's more food options. There's more drinking options. So things are a little bit more spread out. But everyone seemed to really, really enjoy themselves.
I heard they made a record of the most people in Star Trek costumes in one place.
Yeah, the previous record was 691.
It was 91. I think 691.
691.
Oh, wow. Said it. In Germany last year at FedCon.
Over at FedCon. Yeah. And they almost doubled it in Las Vegas this year. It was 1,040 was the new record. And to see all of those fans, maybe we can include it in some of the show notes, but to see all of those costume fans, and there were some really, really incredible costumes this year. In one place, in one room, at one time, it was unreal. It was fantastic. Now,
I heard that there was one person dressed as a Horda. Did you see this? Because I just can only imagine someone scooting around the Rio as a Horda.
I've seen someone dressed as a Horda in previous years. I didn't see one this year. I saw someone with a remote control Horda who was walking through the convention halls with the remote and kind of driving it around as though it was a remote control car. But I didn't catch
sneaking up on people.
Is it mostly people in like Starfleet uniforms, or are people really going all out with like Orion slave girl costumes?
Yeah, what's the percentage of Orion slave girls? There, because in a lot of the photos that we see, there are so many.
There's quite a few, and you know, it really runs the gamut of just, you know, off the shelf Starfleet uniforms to some really, really extravagant costumes that people create at their home during the costume contest that they did this year. One gentleman, he put together this incredible Borg outfit, and I don't even want to think how much he spent to put this thing together. You could have put this into a film. It was that well done.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw a photo of that one. Wow, it's amazing the work people put into these costumes.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
What was the most unusual costume that you did see?
The most unusual was a Starfleet officer, but it was a Lego Starfleet officer. So he had this big, giant yellow head and these big hands and arms and covering his feet. Again, I'm sure I have a photo of it, so I'll share that with you guys.
That's amazing. Yeah. Wow.
God, I wonder if that suit was cooled inside somehow.
Oh, I have no idea.
I'm picturing this guy with giant Legos walking around in Las Vegas. Wow, that's amazing. So, I saw some photos on TrekNews.net that you shot there of the ballroom where they gathered everybody for the world record, and I'm definitely going to have a link to those in the show notes of just great photos and just amazing scene there. I can only imagine being in the middle of that room.
Yeah.
Well, tell us, what was the highlight of the whole con for you this time?
I think depending on who you speak to, everyone's going to have that one thing that really stands out to them about, you know, the 2011 con. But 90% of the people that you talk to, I think, are going to mention Leonard Nimoy's farewell, him saying goodbye to all the fans that, you know, that he's been with over all of these years. As you guys know, and as I'm sure a lot of the listeners know, he had two convention appearances left until he was retiring from conventions. And it was a really, really memorable moment as he was up on the podium and just walking through his career. He showed some of his photography, some poems he shared with everyone listening, and you know, that final farewell. As I was shooting photos, I had to put my camera down for a minute and just take in the moment. As he came out on stage after he had left to a standing ovation, came back out for a second, raised the Vulcan salute, and told everyone to live long. And as he was speaking, his voice cracked, you know, similar to, I'm getting choked up about it, just thinking about it again now.
Yeah.
Prosper. And it was just, it was one of those moments that I think, if you're not a Star Trek fan, it sounds like it's an actor, you don't know him, or you've spent a minute with him getting an autograph or a photo, but it's someone that, you know, I think a lot of fans really relate to and are touched by it in some way. So it was, for me, that was the highlight of the convention.
So you don't feel like this is like Celine Dion, where she had about 20 farewell tours. It really seemed like he's done with conventions and is just going to retire now.
I think it could go either way, but the way that he's been talking and everything that I've been told, this is probably it. He still does have that last convention appearance in Chicago, but you know, in past years, the Chicago convention, or any of them aside from Las Vegas, aren't as big. So this seemed, you know, pretty impactful. And yeah, I think this could be it.
Yeah, and speaking of the scope, the size of the Las Vegas convention, were most of the fans able to see Leonard Nimoy on stage, or was the facility that took place in not large enough for? I mean, I know all the fans can't fit into the room, but how many people were really able to take in that moment?
I had
because I know everyone wanted to. I'm sure.
Oh yeah. That room was packed to the rafters. There were probably close to 5,000 fans in that main convention hall listening to him speak.
Wow.
For Shatner, for all of the other captains, you know, it was very full, but for that one, I think that everyone, you know, made a point to get in there.
Yeah. Cause I think that's the one that everybody there wanted to be in that room. I would imagine.
Yeah, I think everyone knew that was going to be a fairly special moment. So,
yeah.
This is really kind of painful for me because I haven't had a chance to go to a convention. And next year, I plan on going to probably several conventions. And for him to announce his retirement this time is kind of painful for me not to be able to see him. What about people like William Shatner and what other original series cast are still planning on doing conventions? Like George Takei, did he say he'll be retiring too?
No. George Takei was in great spirits. He was okay. Up on stage with John Cho, and they did the quote unquote Sulu Summit.
Sounds great.
Oh my!
Which was a lot of fun. And
I heard John Cho saves Sulu's life from some falling coffee or something.
Yeah, George Takei had a cup of tea with him
okay.
up on stage that he was drinking. And I'm not sure if he had shifted in his chair or something, but the tea spilled on his leg slightly, and John Cho caught the cup. And as he caught the cup, he looks into the mic and looks out into the crowd and says, "I just saved Sulu."
That's great.
That's good. What about, so Shatner was there, and of course he, in addition to speaking, he was roaming around shooting his Fan Addicts documentary, right? Did you have any encounters with him roaming around the Rio?
If you were at the convention this year and you missed Shatner, you have your eyes closed because he was walking around trying to be very inconspicuous this guy must have been 7 feet tall, holding the camera as Shatner stands behind him with a big white hat, telling him to point over here,
the photo.
Get footage of this, get footage of that. But I think most fans caught a glimpse of Shatner shooting Fan Addicts. And, from the footage that he was getting this past weekend, it should be a fun show.
I think my Twitter stream had live footage basically of Shatner because everyone was twit picking.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever he entered a room,
yeah,
suddenly
right.
some people were like, "There's Shatner," and taking pictures of him.
Yeah, no, it's like, guess who just showed up in this room? It's Shatner. And here's the photo with the big white hat on.
Yes, I'm aware of what William Shatner looks like now. Thank you.
As a funny little side note, we were actually fortunate enough to have Shatner show up at our little party on Thursday. He came
oh, wow.
and shot a little footage
oh, wow.
right at the TrekNews.net party that we did with DVD Geeks and Larry Nemechek's Trekland.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about your party, because I was following some of your tweets and your party started, and then I saw you tweet something like the party's moving over to Quarks somewhere, whatever bar you moved over to, and then I didn't hear anything for hours and hours and hours, because it's the middle of the day over here, and I'm like, oh no, what happened to Brian? The party moved.
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, back in California, doing well. The reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. But we hung out over at McFadden's for probably 4 hours. Like I said, William Shatner showed up, Rod Roddenberry showed up. If you guys have seen the Trekkies documentaries, Gabe Kerner was there. A bunch of other people from those films.
Big fan of Kerner's.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's a funny guy. So we hung out there for hours. They had all of the old drinks from Quark's Bar that was formerly located inside the Hilton at the Star Trek Experience. So many a drink was had on Thursday night. Friday morning was a little rough, not too bad. But yeah.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
So tell us about Friday. What was the highlight of Friday?
We had Jonathan Frakes, who was up on stage, and he's always a fun guest at the conventions, but he was in rare form, just walking through the sea of fans and answering fan questions, sitting down in the seats with everyone in the convention hall. He was a blast to see live.
What kind of questions were asked to Frakes? Is there a, I assume there's a movement amongst a lot of the fan base who want to see a Titan TV series. Did that ever come up?
Yeah, that's a question that comes up pretty often. Jonathan, he dispelled some of the rumors of some of the stuff that was going on out there with the rumored TV shows and different things that he was possibly going to be associated with, and talked about the whole Titan television show. But you know, nothing too groundbreaking. It's at these things, it's a lot of the same questions. What did you think of the 2009 movie? If they asked you to be in the next one, would you be in it? A lot of stuff like that. But he was in rare form. He was a lot of fun to have up on stage, and
a lot of fun
working throughout the crowd.
He's directing like every episode of Leverage, it seems like. I think this is the busiest he's been.
Yeah.
Okay, Greg, are you going to start talking about Leverage? Because you already got Eureka canceled. Now you're going to try to get Leverage canceled?
I have never seen an episode of Leverage. I have not seen a single episode. I don't know if Frakes is doing a good job or not. I don't know if you should watch the show. we are supposed to talk about, I think, So You Think You Can Dance.
So You Think You Can Dance.
Which I've seen every
episode. We had episode. A request. All right. Well, we will save our cancellation campaigns for later.
So. We'll move back to Star Trek Las Vegas.
So back to Star Trek Las Vegas, which definitely, even though we're talking about it, do not fear, it will not be canceled. Yes. There will be a Star Trek Las Vegas 2012.
Creation has at least a 3-year contract with the Rio, so we'll be here till at least 2013.
Right. No matter what Greg says. All right. So who else was there? Now, Terry Farrell was there, who has kind of disappeared from the Hollywood scene, I guess, over recent years following her time on Becker. And did you get to see her? Was there anything interesting that came up, any insight into, you know, what she's been doing or her time on DS9?
Yeah, Terry came out on stage on Saturday morning, and she's still just, she looks beautiful. She brought out her son and gave a little insight as to what she's been up to since obviously leaving DS9 and working on Becker and some of the other Hollywood projects that she had. She's actually living back on the East Coast now. She does some yoga instruction and just, you know, living with her family on the East Coast, and she's totally separated from the Hollywood scene. So this was almost her reintroduction into Star Trek fandom and interacting with the fans.
I'm glad to see that even if an actor had maybe a bad experience on Star Trek, they're still able to come back to the convention circuit and interact with fans. And it seems like things are okay. Like, you know, if you're not having to be on the show every week, you can sort of think good thoughts about Star Trek now, even if she wasn't a fan of it at the time. So I'm glad to see people like Terry back out there and doing appearances.
Yeah, she was great to have out there and great to see again, because I've actually never seen her up on stage. So
yeah, I would like to have seen that. And just DS9 is my favorite series. I would have loved to have seen when the last big convention that I was able to go to, it was a really long time ago. It was actually, this was the 45th anniversary convention. The last big convention I was able to go to was the 30th anniversary convention in Huntsville, Alabama. I'm originally from Alabama, and that was 15 years ago. And so at that point, Deep Space Nine was only about halfway through its run. And, you know, wasn't able, and it wasn't really even to the point in the later seasons, which is what has allowed DS9 to kind of become my favorite series. So I would love to be able to go in and see Terry and the other DS9 actors at a con.
Yeah, it's interesting how since then, how big the Star Trek family has ballooned with the rest of DS9, Voyager, and now even Enterprise. One of the panels I would have really liked to see was Dominic Keating and Connor Trinneer, and they seemed like they really bonded on the set of Enterprise, and they're still doing stuff today. Were you at their panel?
I was at their panel briefly on they were on Thursday, and I've seen them together a few different times over the years, and you can really tell that they're good friends. Just the rapport that they have with each other, the way that they go back and forth, kind of giving each other a hard time, giving some of the other cast members a hard time, but it's all in a really friendly, joking manner. Mm-hmm. And they're always a good time to see.
Did you get a chance to see their improv show? That was, I believe, Friday.
Are you talking about the Rat Pack show?
They have a show where they just go out and just do improv together. I was reading, I think Connor talked about it in his StarTrek.com interview. I don't know too much about it, so I was hoping Brian might be able to shed some light on it.
I don't remember hearing about that, actually.
Okay. No. It might not be. It might not have been at Creation. It might just be something they do at some different conventions.
Well, speaking of the Rat Pack,
yeah.
Did you take in that, Brian?
I saw a little bit of the Rat Pack, and they put on a great performance. Those guys are all such a blast to see up on stage. They usually only perform that for the captain's tickets and the gold tickets, which Creation sells the weekend packages for. I don't know. I think they're $700 or $800 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
So it was a real treat for, you know, even the fans that just want to go in for a day and spend 40 or 50 bucks to see everyone, 40 or 50 US for you guys, to be able to see them up on stage. The other really, really fun, I'm not sure if I quite call it a panel, but performance were the Klingons, the Klingon Summit.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which was obviously J.G. Hertzler, Robert O'Reilly, Barbara Marsh, and Gwyneth Walsh. And they were up on stage on
Saturday morning, I think
yeah,
it was, right?
Yeah, these days are all...
Because they had a Klingon lunch after that.
Oh, fun.
Which I hope they didn't serve Gawk. But.
they were a lot of fun. They had the full Klingon makeup going, the whole Klingon character. They performed a Klingon rap up on stage, bringing a bunch of the costumed fans up with them. And it was fun.
Oh, wow. So Worf is into Klingon opera, but this was Klingon rap.
Yeah, this was Klingon hip-hop. No beatboxing, but
wow, it's
still
that
a lot
would
of
be
fun.
Very interesting to see there.
Great.
I bet the turnout was very large for the Klingon panel.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Star Trek fans
such
love,
a huge Klingon
love
following.
The Klingons. Sure.
Definitely. So apart from the actors being there, what kind of things, of course, there's the expo, all the merchandise, other events going on. Tell us a little bit about the things that were on hand this time.
The dealer's room this year was probably comparable to how it's been in previous years over at the Hilton. There's a few new dealers in that room now. There's some Star Trek robes. But I'm not sure if you guys have seen, but those things are fantastic.
The bathrobes?
Yeah. I've had a few friends
pick
those up.
Yeah, I've seen them on Think Geek, I believe. I saw in some of the photos of people in costumes, I saw a few people who were wearing just those robes to the convention as their costumes.
Wow.
But if there's a Star Trek item that you've been searching for, that's the place to go. Obviously, you can search around the internet, but to go in there and, you know, pick up the Bat'leth if you want to, and inspect its quality. There's nothing like being there live and kind of inspecting the stuff and checking it out and figuring out what it is that your wife or girlfriend's going to allow you to hang on the wall.
Yeah, and a lot of people come out of that room with lighter wallets, I am sure.
Of course, and Stuart Baird goes to the convention and thinks about buying things and then doesn't.
That's right. I liked the mask. I thought about buying it. I didn't. Stuart Baird's commentary from Nemesis, which is our feature for today.
Okay.
Coming up. It just cracks me up. And he uses the elevator to get there. Not the turbo lift.
Right.
But so what was the most unusual item that you saw in the dealer's room there's got to be some pretty crazy stuff in there. I mean, Batleth's pretty normal, so
yeah. The strangest item, I don't know. The Star Trek Enterprise, the salt and pepper shakers really stood out to me as something that it's kind of a fun little trinket to have, but I'm not sure how strange that might be if you have, you know, friends over for dinner and it's like, oh, could you pass the salt, and you're handing them the Enterprise. But
I'm waiting for the salt vampire salt shaker before I buy them.
I'm with you on that.
I thought it was odd in the JJ film, the bar that they're in at the beginning has, it might even be the ship from the beginning of the film, but at least it's a Federation starship, salt shaker, there at the bar. I wonder if that's something that,
oh, yeah.
Are there, you know, like near Boeing, can you go to a bar that has 747 salt shakers?
Probably.
Little iMac salt shakers in Cupertino.
Oh, those are standard on the new Apple campus, I'm sure. Yeah. So, did they have any gaming stuff set up? I'm kind of curious if they had any type of hands-on ability to play that new Star Trek game that's coming out for the consoles, based on the Abrams verse.
They didn't have that. There was a few of the Star Trek deck building games you could play there, and they had some folks on hand to teach you if you're interested in. Want to pick up one of the decks, but no, I didn't see any. They didn't have any of the games there, which was unfortunate because I've been looking forward to checking those out myself.
Yes, speaking of the JJ stuff, was there much from the JJ movie there, or did it seem mostly aimed towards prime timeline fans?
I would say most of the items, and you know, this is probably because there's, you know, this 43 years of Star Trek previous to JJ's.
Right.
There's obviously more of the prime stuff in the dealer's room. The JJ stuff, you know, there's going to be posters, there's t-shirts. A lot of the figures you see kind of hanging there on the pegs. I'm not sure if that has something to do with, you know, folks just being more interested in the prime timeline or what, but.
Well, I think the only actor from the new film that was there was John Cho.
Yeah.
And none of the writers seem to be there. I mean, they probably don't want to get endless questions about when the next film's coming out, but
that's why they didn't come. They don't want anyone asking them, why aren't you writing? What are you doing here? You're supposed to be writing a script.
It just seemed a little odd that there was a bigger presence for the new Star Trek timeline at Comic-Con this year than at this Star Trek Las Vegas, where I thought they might have some sort of announcements or something, or at least just trying to keep that new timeline alive in fans' minds.
The thing is, San Diego Comic-Con and Star Trek Las Vegas are just two different animals. Comic-Con is a convention where these big companies go to make their big announcements, and all of the news outlets are there to cover it and give them publicity for them. Star Trek Las Vegas is a little bit, like I said, a different animal in that it's more of the celebrities kind of reliving their days on the television show, not really announcing new products or you know, something new that they're up to. So it's a little bit different. But.
It sounds like a more laid back experience than something like Comic-Con, where it's constant announcements. You have to get to this panel because you're going to hear something groundbreaking and new, or you're going to see some new footage. It seems like you're able to just have a more relaxed experience and maybe even get some one-on-one time with one of these actors.
I think the fans are able to have a little bit more relaxed experience. Personally, if I slept 4 hours each night, I was doing pretty good because I was running around and, you know, live tweeting all of the panels and up in front, you know, taking photographs for the website and writing my report and writing down notes and writing down quotes. So, so it wasn't quite relaxing for me, but I'm sure, you know, most fans going have a pretty relaxed time and sit there and enjoy the panels.
Well, speaking of the fans, I think... First of all, did I hear correctly that this was the largest turnout? It was a record turnout for Star Trek Las Vegas this year?
I haven't confirmed that yet. That's something that William Shatner had mentioned on stage. And I don't, and I don't want to confirm or deny that either way, just because I haven't gotten confirmation myself. But yeah, there was, it looked larger than previous years. I can definitely say that.
Yeah, I was wondering about, you know, the health of Star Trek, because Star Trek, anything lasting this long is just incredible to imagine that it can last this long. And we had that period of time during the kind of the late 90s, early 2000s, where it kind of felt like interest was waning a little bit on the part of the studio, especially on the part of some of the fans a little bit. You know, we're going to talk about Nemesis in our feature today, and Nemesis came at a point where it kind of felt like fan interest was way down. And for all of the things about the JJ reboot that a lot of longtime Star Trek fans aren't happy about, one thing that I've really been happy about with what they're doing with the JJ reboot is that it's rekindling interest in Star Trek, and it can bring new blood in. And so ultimately, you know, I want to see the healthy Star Trek energized fan base, both old and new, and so we can eventually get new Star Trek on television. We keep the movies going. And what was the kind of atmosphere over all of the fans this year at the show? Did it seem even more? I know it's energized because you wouldn't be going there if you weren't a huge Star Trek fan, but does it feel like an energy building even more than in past years?
It feels like, you know, obviously everyone that's there has a certain place in their heart for Star Trek and has a really deep passion to go to Las Vegas and spend 4 or 5, sometimes 6, 7 days there, just bringing your family and enjoying this this franchise. But everyone there seemed really, really excited about, you know, whether it was Next Generation or Voyager or Enterprise or DS9 or the original series. Everyone has that one series they're really, really in love with. And the nice thing to see is some of the younger generation that I see coming up, and you know, also some ladies that are kind of being brought into the fold of Star Trek. During the 2009 convention, I remember just seeing a bunch of younger people, and it's been building and building and building over these past 3 years. So it's nice to see, you know, like I said, some younger people showing up at these things and just becoming really invested in this franchise that we all know and love.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, if you bring in a new fan to Star Trek, there's so much rich content for them to get to. Like, you know, if you have a kid and you want to introduce them to Star Wars, you can polish off those movies in a weekend. But to introduce someone to Star Trek is a month-long process at best. It took me a good 2 or 3 months to watch through DS9 a couple years ago. And so there's always, I feel like Star Trek isn't something you can get too sick of, because you can always go back and watch an episode again, and it's going to be fresh to you because there's just so much to watch. You can't have watched it too recently. And so yeah, it's really great that this is happening.
Totally, totally. Star Trek is one of those things that you can really immerse yourself in. And some of these new fans that just caught the movie in 2009 are getting really amped up about the next movie, whether it's 2012 or 2013. And if they go back and watch the original series or watch TNG, they can just really, really immerse themselves in so many seasons and so many episodes, and you know, all of these books that are out, and you know, there's just so much for the fans to get jazzed about. But you know, it makes me excited to work on the website and see all of this excitement building and still be present around this franchise.
Exactly. So do you have any plans already in the works for next year's Star Trek Las Vegas for TrekNews.net?
I was before I got on the air with you guys, I was just telling my girlfriend, mark down your calendars. August 9th through 12th is Las Vegas Star Trek Convention 2012.
We're planning on being there and seeing you in person, Brian.
Oh, you guys too. I can't wait for it. Looking forward to it.
It'll be a lot of fun. It'll be my first convention probably, if I can make it. So I'm sure I'll be quite excited to help cover it.
Yeah, and you've got to see Greg's costume. He's going as a glamour.
Yes. I want him to have my glamour costume and a picture with a glamour.
Oh, yeah.
Glamour overload.
He will pay any amount of money for a photo of himself with a glamour.
That sounds great.
I don't know what it is about Greg and glamours, but all right. Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us today. And before we go, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about TrekNews.net and where they can find you and all the great Star Trek news that you've got going on there.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. TrekNews.net, we launched April of this past year, and we've just been ramping up the quality of all the stories, the photography that goes along with them, our live coverage of all of these conventions that go on throughout the United States, everything related to the news of the new movie, related to the stars from the previous television and films, television shows and films. So it's your daily dose of everything Star Trek over at TrekNews.net.
All right. Yeah, it's a great site and a great place where Greg and I often go to catch up on what's going on every day in Star Trek as well. So we encourage everybody to head over there to Brian's site at TrekNews.net.
Thank you very much.
In 2002, after a four-year wait, we finally got a new TNG film. Nemesis is a movie that wasn't quite what the fans were expecting. It had some very surprising twists and turns, and is often blamed for killing TNG on the big screen. In today's feature, we'll take a look at Nemesis and find out what was good and what was bad, and some things that we just kind of scratch our heads over. So, Greg, Star Trek Nemesis, this is the, I would say, probably aptly named film if it were named after its director, who, after having listened to his commentary, I might say was a franchise's nemesis, and that is Stuart
Wow,
Baird.
Wow, this is the famous warp drive.
Yes, apparently the famous warp drive. Oh my gosh. We're just going to talk about Nemesis today. This is, I think, a film that a lot of Star Trek fans want to forget. Which, you know, I kind of have had a fairly favorable view of this film over the years, and I went back and I've been rewatching it, listening to commentaries, you know, to get ready to talk about this. And I don't know, some of my feelings changed just a little bit. How did you feel about Nemesis?
Yeah, my feelings about Nemesis are weird. Kind of interesting to think about. For my entire life, there was Star Trek, you know, every 2 years until Insurrection, which was 98. And then there was a four-year gap. And so we had this big wait for this next film, and everyone was wondering, you know, what are they going to do? Is it going to be a bigger film? Is it going to be a smaller film? They brought on a new writer, a new director, obviously kept the same cast for this one, but it was a very new thing they were doing, which is strange to do in sort of new direction for the last film. They made it quite clear that this was going to be this generation's final voyage. And so I think fans went in with a lot of expectations and a lot of expectations, and they expected something like Star Trek VI, which was such a great ending for a franchise. It was just the perfect encapsulation. It finished everyone's storylines. It had this great heart and a really good plot too, that was really timely as well. So when Nemesis came out, I just don't think that it met people's expectations. And so a lot like Enterprise, you sort of have to go back and think of it, you know, don't think of it this is the only Star Trek you can go watch in the theater right now. You know, this is Next Generation's final film. Just think of it as a Star Trek film, and how does it work on that level? And I think I find more to like in Nemesis than to dislike. There are, in my opinion, some pretty terrible Star Trek films out there that I just can't sit through, much less sit through without laughing. This one I take pretty seriously. I think the threat of the villain is serious, the plot is serious, the space battles are really incredible. So the flaws of the film we can definitely talk about, but I would say that this ranks pretty highly for me as far as a next-gen film.
Interesting. that kind of echoes my feelings about it over the years. And I wonder, of course, they did bill it when it was being released as a generation's final journey. And I've always kind of wondered, even from the time going back to when those posters were coming out, was that done because they really intended for this to be the final Next Generation film, or was it, or were they kind of covering their asses on this? You know, like,
Yeah.
were they thinking like, we may have a stinker on our hands here, or we're just
Like
we're
someone
not.
saw the final cut and said, maybe we should just let this one be.
Right. Or they, the franchise was kind of waning at that time. There was a lot of burned out feeling in the franchise. Even going back to Insurrection in 98, it really felt like they were starting to go through the motions. Things were getting a little comfortable. They were kind of at a peak at that point, but then, Insurrection didn't do so hot at the box office. And then DS9 wrapped and Voyager was wrapping up. And as we've talked about before, Voyager, the final seasons of Voyager, there was kind of, I feel, a little bit of strain between the network and the studio actually producing the show. And then Enterprise came along and there was all this strain. So anyway, I guess my point is that I don't know if this was really, really intended to be the last TNG film truly. Like, if this had done really well at the box office, we may have seen them come back. And you see that in the cutscene at the end, the different ending that wasn't in the movie. That ending was kind of to send the ship off on its next adventure versus the ending that we actually got, which was a very poor attempt to just kind of end a movie without, really leaving it open to too much else other than the before thing.
Yeah, I'd wonder what it would have been like had we gotten this one in 2000. They probably would have gotten Frake to direct. In 2002, he was busy making Clockstoppers, which is a film I saw, but I don't think many other people did. And so he was pretty busy making that. He couldn't direct this one. But if in 2000 they had made that Star Trek film and had Riker go off on his own ship, had brought on this new first officer, and at that point, Voyager would have still been on the air. They weren't thinking about Enterprise yet. I think it's possible that this could have been the next to last or the first in a longer series of next gen films. I think because it took so long to come out, and because Brent Spiner said he was done playing Data, that I think they had to admit to themselves that Next Gen was finished. Probably before it needed to be, but just because of the way Star Trek was. I mean, even ignoring the sort of going through the motions of Insurrection and the last couple years of Voyager, just the franchise was wanting to go in a new direction, and whether Enterprise was that direction or now this new JJ thing is the new direction, I don't think that in 2002 there was more legs to Next Gen, which is sad because, as Berman talks about, the Next Gen cast was really close at this point. They had such a tight family.
Well, you can tell that on
And
camera too.
oh yeah.
You
Yeah,
know,
and that's part of why bringing in Stuart Baird didn't work so well, because it's like you have this tight, close-knit family, and then suddenly you bring in, a stepfather, and he
Well,
doesn't know anybody.
let's talk about that for a second. So, some of my feelings on this, my personal feelings anyway, have been that First Contact was such a huge success, and Jonathan Frakes directed that. And so the studio, of course, brought Frakes back to direct Insurrection, which didn't do so well at the box office. But again, as we've said many times, in terms of real Star Trek and in terms of Next Generation, Insurrection was a really good movie and a really good story. And it really was Next Generation. And I say they go through the motions, I feel like they were kind of on autopilot a bit, but at the same time, I think that having someone like Jonathan Frakes at the helm directing was important because what we got was we really got what we wanted as Star Trek fans and as people who love these Next Generation characters. And but it didn't do so well at the box office, and so I've always felt like the studio wanted to kind of shift gears, like, okay, things are kind of sinking on us here. We have to do something new. Why don't we bring in a new director who has no knowledge of Star Trek, and let's give Star Trek this all new look and all new vision, and let's, you know, see what happens if we go off in this new direction where no one has gone before, kind of thing. And I don't know. My seeing the movie in the theater, I can come away with it with the feeling like this was a different kind of Star Trek movie. It really looked different. It felt different. But, you know, it was still a interesting movie to watch. And as a movie, I liked it fine. And but then as I learned more and more about what went on behind the scenes, and then when I listened to Stuart Baird's commentary, and it started to get to me like, you know, I think the studio kind of made a mistake here. And because Stuart Baird not only knew nothing about Star Trek, he apparently made no effort to find out anything about Star Trek either. And to the point where it doesn't come through as much on film, because I think that they, by Rick Berman and others fighting to keep in certain material or to keep certain lines, they were able to salvage it as a Star Trek film. I'm not sure that he even approached it, though, as he was making a Star Trek film. He was making a science fiction film, and just like be damned with all of the Star Trek canon and history. Let's just do whatever we want to do here and forget about the fans.
I think what really saved it for some of that is that John Logan wrote the script.
Yes,
and
exactly.
He's a newcomer to Star Trek, but as far as the Star Trek family, he's a newcomer, but he was a huge fan. He knew all the shows, all the movies, backwards and forwards. Rick Berman says that he knew some of the stuff better than even he did. And this is the guy who was in charge of Star Trek at the time.
For a long time.
We started with this great script. I really believe in this script. I need to go back and find like the original shooting script. I've heard really good things about it. But you can just tell on screen that these characters know who they are. They're acting like themselves. It's not an off the wall sort of. I bring up Star Trek V again. We don't have a bunch of people acting like they wouldn't act in any of the other movies. We have people being themselves. It's just the editing cuts it down so much. You lose little bits of personality, and I think it wasn't taken to the next level that it could have been had you had a director, LeVar Burton or Jonathan Frakes, or even if they could have got Nicholas Meyer. There's a story behind that we could get into. But just because they had Baird, it wasn't able to get brought to the next level. But can we talk about a few of the things that Baird brought to the table, some of the new things he did? He darkened the color palette. All the panels on the Enterprise are made a lot darker and a lot bluer. He said he didn't really like the browns and what color are they usually? They're like brown and green, multicolored.
The LSARS displays. Yeah, well, they're very
displays. Yeah,
yeah, multicolored. You know, you've got yellows and purples and oranges and all kinds of stuff going on those screens.
But in this film, they're a lot darker and this blue. And I'm not a fan of that. But other things he did. He put the bridge on a gimbal, which is basically. How do I explain if you don't know what it is? But it's a big stage that can move. So when the ship is rocked, instead of the actors sort of all going to the left, to the right, they're actually being shaken. I think it really comes through on film. I think some of these battle scenes are really dynamic because of that.
Yeah, well, to put a gimbal into perspective, it's like if you were Greg and me living in Japan, we live on a gimbal.
Yes, exactly.
Our entire country is on a giant gimbal. And thankfully, that way, when the earthquakes come, everything else shakes. Otherwise, we would have to just flail back and forth in our house to simulate the earthquake, and it wouldn't be much fun. So that was a good idea that he had there.
We were talking on Twitter about everything being Stuart Baird's fault. Are you saying that the Japanese earthquake was Stuart Baird's fault?
Maybe. I think he said that he planned it very carefully. These scenes have to be planned very carefully. But what you're saying there, I do agree with. From a cinematic perspective, I do like some of the ideas that he brought to the table. It does have more of a big screen cinematic feeling to it. You feel like you're watching a movie. First Contact had a pretty good movie feel to it. Insurrection didn't really have that movie feel to it. Generations didn't have it so much. Nemesis really, because of choices like the type of filtering of light on the planet on Calaris 3, the darkening of the palettes, some of the changing of the way the weapons work, these kind of like a pulsating, quick frame pulsations of the phasers versus the streams that we would normally see on Star Trek. That's something
JJ ended up doing in the new film too, is these just quick short bursts.
Yeah, I like it better. I know it probably upsets a lot of fans because it's a big departure from Star Trek, but in terms of the energy and the excitement and a more realistic cinematic feel, I think it works quite well. So these are types of visions that he did bring to the table that I think work well. My problems come in when it gets into the actual relationship between the Star Trek characters more where things kind of fall apart for me.
Well, on the topic of it just feeling bigger, I mean the Scimitar set, the bridge set, is just an incredibly huge set that's really impressive. And he talks about getting a crane in there to do some really dynamic shots all through the film. That stuff they didn't really do so much. Something like Star Trek II, they had basically the Phase II bridge set, which then they redressed to be the Reliant set. And so it's as good a film as Wrath of Khan is, it doesn't have as grand a scale because so much of the film is simply on this one pretty small set, whereas you've got the Scimitar Bridge, you have the Romulan Senate Hall, which is the same actually as the wedding reception set. But these are pretty big sets for Star Trek. We're used to either pretty small sets or going on location.
Yeah, that's true.
And even when they go on location, they do something fantastic like this. I know not everyone loves the car chase with the nameless, faceless aliens, but it's at least exciting, and it's something we've never seen in Star Trek before.
Well, speaking of the nameless, faceless aliens, they actually look like the little guy that's with Scotty in the J.J. Abrams movie. I almost wonder if... Are they the same race? they look really similar. They reused the makeup. I don't know. The car chase scene is, again, it's an element that you don't get on the TV series that gives you this cinematic feel. It's a little bit odd for Star Trek. But you could tell they were having fun. You could tell Patrick Stewart was having a blast.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And it did give you, I think that in this case, Baird achieved his goal that he mentioned on his commentary of trying to make it feel like they were on the surface of an alien planet instead of just in the desert outside Los Angeles, just using some cinematic techniques.
I mean, I just watched Datalore last week, and not even thinking of the parallels between the films at the time, but now after watching Nemesis again, wow, there's some similarities here. But when you watch that episode, they beam down to Data's home planet, and, you know, it's the same soundstage they're always on, you know, with some odd light in the background. They walk over, 3 meters to a door into the Planet Hell cave set. And, you know, it feels so tiny and everything's right there. Whereas it wouldn't really be like that. So it's so great to see it in this one. They're driving around. They've got to find the different parts of his body.
I saw on Twitter yesterday, someone tweeted that it's amazing how when you see Star Trek TOS on television reruns, when you flip through, no matter what episode it is, it always looks like the show is stuck on the same scene because of that, you know. So this is a case of getting out. You know, the thing about this car chase scene for me, though, the main thing where it kind of fell apart for me was the ending where they radio control the captain's yacht off the cliff, and then they dive, and then they land. And it's kind of like when they crash land the shuttle into the Enterprise in Star Trek V.
Yes. It's that mixed with Tomorrow Never Dies, the James Bond film from the 90s.
Right, which is another case where I'm not sure that Baird realized that he was making a Star Trek movie. But anyway, it was an okay scene. And then, of course, they have to find B4 there. to set into motion some other things. And what
can we,
about?
Can we talk about the name for a second?
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't we talk about B4 for a minute? Not just the name, but the entire storyline.
He was originally called B9,
yeah.
Which I'm really glad they didn't go with B9. Anyway, he's an interesting idea. Obviously, Logan was interested in this idea of the nemesis, which that word comes from the idea of sort of a doppelganger or a copy. And he wanted to play with that as we were focusing in this film on Picard and Data. So let's give Data a brother, which they did before. But this is a very different way of doing it. In some ways, there's a different way than they did it the first time.
Right. Lore was the evil Data. And as Baird said in his commentary, B4 is the idiot version of Data. Which I thought again that, well, okay, that's an interesting way. I'm not sure if I would have put it exactly that way. But okay, so I definitely get where John Logan was going with B4. Although I'm a little surprised to hear you suggest here that this was a TNG movie that was focusing on Picard and Data. That's quite a novel idea.
I know.
Every TNG movie focuses on Picard and Data.
We even had a scene between the two of them in Stellar Cartography, which I think every single Star Trek film has to have.
Yeah, although it was Stellar Cartography from Voyager, as opposed to the very grandiose one that we got in Generations, which was amazing.
Was the Enterprise D. You see, there's a lot of space on the I know. On the E.
They forgot to allocate space on the E for Stellar Cartography. Yeah. But so I get where Logan was going with the concept of B4 and as a parallel between Picard and Shinzon and Data and B4. But did it work for you? Because for me, the whole storyline of B4 kind of gets lost a little bit. I mean, the Picard Shinzon obviously is the main storyline and it's very fleshed out. And then I feel like there's this other thing going on with Data that's just there because we need a parallel with what's going on with Picard. And the movie actually could pretty much do without this entire B4 storyline.
Right. And obviously we were talking about Generations a few weeks ago and we said, you know, in that one, they could have cut the whole Data storyline as well. I do at least think that this movie did more with the B4 plotline than Generations did with the emotion ship plotline, because we find out the B4 was working for Shinzon, and we have this really interesting thing where I think I said on Twitter, I'm not sure Stuart Baird ever saw Data lore, but at least Data
did. Sure not.
Because
Data saw Data lore.
Data,
I hope.
Data knows not to give B4 full access to the ship's computer. He actually tricks him and gives him wrong information. So at least the storylines are connected.
Yeah.
Although I do agree they probably could have dropped it quite a bit.
You know, I'm not necessarily saying that I wanted them to drop the storyline. I guess I if they were gonna have it, I think I wanted to see more development of the relationship between Data and B4, instead of just having B4 is this new long lost brother of Data who we've never heard of before, who is suddenly working for this new praetor of the Romulan Empire, which is another implausible storyline. That's just like, well, how are we going to bring the Enterprise into this storyline with Shinzon in the first place? How is he going to bring them to Romulus? Well, okay, let's have another android. And I don't know. It just, for me, it was kind of, I guess I also have some negative feelings about this storyline because of the way that it was used to close the film, which we can talk about later when we get to the end of the film. So we don't kind of sidetrack on that right now, but
I guess I would say I'm happier with the B4 storyline than I am with the emotion chip storyline. It's not as strong as the storyline with the Borg Queen. I think that one worked really well.
We weren't
sure of Data's motivations or what Data was going to do, and he had to actually do this big heroic thing at the end. I mean, obviously, Nemesis, he also does a big heroic thing at the end. But it's sort of undercut by B4 being there, and it's like, you know,
Exactly.
we spent so much time proving, like, to ourselves and to Starfleet that Data is an actual person. And then we say, well, it doesn't matter that he died. There's a copy of him.
Yeah, exactly.
And
That's, yeah.
it's like if Kirk, I don't know. It's sort of what they did with Spock, certainly, but at least they didn't do it with Spock in the same film.
Well, yeah. In the case of Spock, it worked okay for me because, I don't know, we had this idea. Well, I mean, to be honest, I have to think back whether it was really established very much before that or not, this idea of a Katra, but at least it felt like, okay, I can believe that there somehow the Vulcans have this belief, you know, that you can pass on your memories. And I
Right.
mean, of course, it's implausible that you're going to have a body regenerated by the Genesis device and you're going to take them back and transfer and all this stuff. But overall, the storyline for me, it was something that I could buy into as a Star Trek fan. I could buy into it. And then we got a Spock who was different than the Spock that we had before to
Right.
start. And then we were able to watch him grow and become the Spock he was, and then even move beyond that later on. So the Spock thing worked fine for me. And of course, maybe if we had had more Next Generation films and we could see
Yeah.
B4 evolve, maybe I'd feel differently about it. But it just really, really kind of weakened the entire
Yeah.
sacrifice that Data made. It's like, okay, it's like when they kill, we talked about this on a previous show, when they killed Jadzia Dax on DS9, and then
Oh,
yet
yeah.
here we have Ezri Dax. It's like, no, I mean, I understand that the Trill symbiote gets passed on and on and on, but that's when you have an opportunity to pass the symbiote on. I mean, if we're going to kill Jadzia, let's not replace her immediately. It weakens the whole thing, and that's what happened here with B4 too.
And then if you read the lead in to the 2009 film, the comic book Star Trek Countdown, you just have Commander Data. You know,
Yeah.
it's like this whole thing never even happened. You know, he's back, he's running normal. No one even it's like when the new Kim came from the parallel universe on Voyager. It was never brought up again that this isn't the same guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like it didn't even matter.
Yeah, right. All right. So, well, that's what happened with Data. Why don't we talk about the Picard Shinzon storyline a little bit, the other main
Yeah.
storyline here.
So this one, I wanted to lead into it by mentioning I've watched Nemesis more times than I really understand why, because it's not my favorite Star Trek film. But I've watched it many times, and actually a couple times with my girlfriend. And the first time she saw the scene where Shinzon was revealed, she literally had no idea what was going on. They talked about how Tom Hardy doesn't really look like Patrick Stewart, and they did some different makeup to make it work. But I think the scene just doesn't do a good job of communicating to the audience that this is a clone of Picard. And I think there just must have been something else they could have done. And I have some ideas, but I want to hear what you thought of the idea of doing a Picard clone.
Oh gosh. I mean, I don't have a problem with the idea of doing a Picard clone. It's not the first time that we've had our characters on Star Trek cloned. But I don't know. It's another one of these things that just kind of comes out suddenly. So the Romulans have bred this clone of Picard all these decades ago, and yet it's never come up before. And then they had like some aborted plan that they were going to use to replace Picard with this clone. And of course, a
It's
clone
like
that.
a fourth season storyline that they didn't ever get to.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, see, I could see it as an episode. Like, there's this episode of Next Generation where the Romulans kidnap Picard and replace him with a clone. You know, kind of like in DS9 when we had a long stretch of time where Bashir on the station was not Bashir. It
Right.
was a
Yeah, that was
changeling
cool.
pretending to be Bashir. And it was done well because you didn't quite know at first what was going on. So, you know, I could see an episode or if Next Generation had had a more serialized nature like Deep Space Nine, a series of episodes in which Picard had been replaced by this clone, Shinzon.
that would have been awesome, actually.
I could definitely see that within the TV series, and it could have made a really great storyline. It felt a little bit kind of just pulled out of nowhere for the movie here, but it's okay. You know, I mean, I can overlook that and just take it for what it is for a movie. I think Tom Hardy, I think he did a really nice acting job in this movie because he was, you know, really an unknown, inexperienced actor when he came in here. And to play against Patrick Stewart as well as he did, I think was very admirable, and he did an excellent job. But I think, like so many things in this movie, there are a lot of things that are left for you to figure out that aren't really sufficiently presented. And it's especially hard because in these Star Trek movies that are made for the general audience, as Star Trek fans, we can fill in the gaps because we know the backstory. But when you have a director who doesn't know the backstory himself, and he wants to leave out or cut out critical scenes, makes it much more difficult.
He wanted to cut the wedding out.
Well, that's what I was going
to open the film without the wedding.
Yeah, I was going to mention earlier when you were talking about that, but we kind of jumped ahead that, yeah, he wanted to cut out the wedding scene. And if there's anything in this movie that makes it a movie for fans, it's the wedding scene. And if this is going to be the last Next Generation movie, please let us have these moments like the wedding scene where Riker and Troy finally get married, and there's this kind of family moment. And, you know, I'll tell you one thing in these movies, and we talk about how comfortable the Next Generation cast is. The look on Marina Sirtis's face when Picard is speaking to Riker and Troy there is one of the most natural things that I've ever seen in Star Trek. Just the emotion on her face, and you could tell that they have been together for so many years. So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about, I'm not really a big fan of the way, is it Generations sort of opens with the scene on the ship Enterprise. And it's fun, it's funny, but it doesn't really work for me. This wedding scene really works for me on so many levels.
That's true.
Everybody together, everybody's comfortable. I wish I could see the extended version of it.
Yeah, the opening in Generations on the ship, it worked fine for me as a Next Generation thing. But you're right, this really, really works for this not just the characters, but the cast as well. And having, you know, having Whoopi Goldberg back, having Will Wheaton back, even though their bigger scenes got cut out of the movie, but just seeing them there was a perfect moment. And I almost fell out of my chair when I found out that he wanted to just cut that whole scene, much less the fact that he wanted to cut the little jokes like Worf being drunk on Romulan ale, or Worf saying Irvin Berlin, you know, is a reference back to him not knowing composers in Insurrection. Yep. I mean, he just didn't get the film. So,
we were talking about Shinzon.
Yeah, let's jump back to Shinzon here.
I wanted to say that I think it was a real missed opportunity when you have an actor who, at least you're trying to have him play a young Picard, to not have any scenes of young Picard. We talk about these Star Trek films never seeming big enough. And there's a couple of things that can help a movie feel big. One is going to different planets, different areas of space. And I think this movie pulled that off really well. We're on Earth, we're at Romulus, Celis II. We're moving around. But one thing the new Star Trek film did was actually move us around in time and show us these characters progressing, show them as young, show them as getting older. And I really would have loved to have had a scene of Picard in the Academy days. We could have even finally seen him in the fight that damaged his heart. We could have done that whole scene in Starfleet Academy. I'm sure it would have been expensive, but use that maybe at the start of the film to establish Tom Hardy as Picard. And then when you have the reveal of Shinzon, you say, oh, that's Picard. You don't have to have this whole scene where he's mumbling about, I can see as well as you can see, I can feel exactly what you feel. Instantly you say, that's Picard, because you already saw him earlier. And so I think it was a real missed opportunity.
Yeah, I agree. That would have worked. Something like that would have worked. I think you'd have to figure out how to cut it so that it worked within the film without, bogging things down too much.
Oh,
But
sure.
definitely that. Yeah, that's what I was thinking when you asked me a few minutes ago about that. Some kind of flashback moments to establish the character. Because you do, I think they kind of tried to throw you off when the Viceroy comes on the view screen and Picard thinks that he's Shinzon.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah,
There's
like
so many things in here.
there's a scene of Shinzon talking to the fleet captains and it kind of comes early in the film where he's telling them, I don't need the fleet with me. I only need the scimitar, and he's going through a lot of that. And that would have been the reveal of Shinzon, but Baird said, no, we must save the reveal until Picard can see him, so we can be Picard. And I'm thinking, if it's that obvious, A, why did you shoot this earlier scene? And B, if it's so obvious, why didn't you make it work better? And I think it comes down to the fact that I don't know if we talked about, but they weren't sure what they were going to do. Was it going to be Patrick Stewart playing himself? Was it going to be a clone the same age as Patrick? Was it going to be his son? I think they decided because that was a TV episode, they wouldn't do that. So because it was so late in the process that they decided to do it this way, they weren't able to make the script work in that area.
Do you think it would have been a better movie if Patrick Stewart had played himself and the clone had been accelerated in aging to the point where he was the same age as Picard right now? Because if they were going to replace Picard, if the idea was the Romulans created this clone because they were going to replace Picard in part of a plot to infiltrate Starfleet, he would need to look like Picard at that moment in time. I mean, he couldn't have been a younger Picard. It's like, what happened? Well, you remember that incident in Rascals? Well, just kind of the transporter beam, just kind of, they ran out of juice when they were bringing me back. And so Guinan was fine, Ro was fine, but me, I just kind of only got about halfway there, but I'm back, was that going to be the Romulans' plan? I don't know.
If I had been writing this film, I probably would have had Picard be kidnapped after the wedding and had the first half of the film with, I probably wouldn't have called him Shinzon, but whoever this Romulan agent was, I would have had him commanding the Enterprise and then had the real Picard off in a jail cell somewhere. That could have been quite interesting, more so than what they ended up with. I'm not sure if they wanted Patrick Stewart. It would have been a lot of work for him to play two versions of himself. I mean, we have Data doing it, but that's a subplot, so it's not quite as big a deal.
I don't know. It could have been a budgetary thing. I mean, if I'm sure if Patrick Stewart were playing two roles like that, maybe it would have demanded more. I don't know. I mean, yeah, your story sounds like it would have made a good movie. It would have been more of a Star Trek story. And maybe that's the thing here. Of course, we are talking about John Logan writing the script, and he is absolutely a Star Trek fan, so no fault for him. And like you said earlier, that kind of salvaged the film. And thank goodness we had him writing it, because if we had had a writer who was as fresh as Stuart Baird was to Star Trek, I don't even know what we would have gotten. But it wouldn't have been Star Trek. So what, okay, other positive things in this movie for me. Again, I do feel that if you can come to this movie kind of in the way that you do the JJ movie, in that you can watch this as a movie and you can watch it as a Star Trek movie. And as a movie, I think that this is a pretty good film. The directing isn't bad. It's just that there's a lack of understanding of Star Trek here, and the characters especially. And that gets kind of covered up a bit because the actors know who they are as characters so well that the lack of knowledge on the part of Baird is not enough to overcome the fact that the characters absolutely know who they are, and so they're able to play it. But the action is there, the cinematic feel is there. As a science fiction action movie, I think that it's pretty good. And I don't actually mind the change in the look as far as, because I don't mind seeing Star Trek evolve. Again, I've said before, I guess it's kind of the designer in me. I know things have to evolve. You can't, you know, you look at companies, you don't keep a brand looking the same forever, most brands anyway. Right. I mean, it's why Pepsi comes out with a new logo every few years, no matter how ridiculous some of the transitions may appear. Of course, then you've got the tried and true and Coca-Cola, but even they overall will change their image here and there. So I don't mind kind of this transition in the look. The Enterprise E is beautiful. The sets look great. So I think it works
as far as
a movie.
As far as positives, yeah, like there's a lot of positive in this film. You talk about the look of the Enterprise E. These space battles in this one are just fantastic. I mean, you look back at the Frakes-directed films, First Contact, we start with this really great battle, but if you watch it, it's actually really short, and it probably is as good as Nemesis, but we don't quite get back to that. Insurrection had what could have been a really great action scene, but I think they just didn't have the budget and there wasn't the focus on it. In this one, we have this really well-directed battle between the Enterprise and the Scimitar, and then the two Romulan warbirds join in. The effects are fantastic. The sets on gimbals are really good. The scale of the Scimitar bridge set comes into play. It's really, really good.
What Nemesis does in terms of these battles and like the collision of the Enterprise-E and the Scimitar, which I love, because how many times has... forgetting the reset button, like, you know, we talked about in Europe Hill, how many times has a Starfleet captain threatened to ram the ship into something and then chickened out at the end, you know, to see Picard and Picard, especially because Picard is so, he thinks things through so much and he's going to always find, you know, very, very carefully approach a situation, to see him actually just ram the Enterprise-E and the Scimitar. And I love the little inside joke here, which I'm sure was completely lost on Stuart Baird, of putting Troy at the helm and then having her be the one who flies the ship into the Scimitar to crash the Enterprise for a second time.
I like the idea that Picard wasn't there when Troy crashed the ship. He just found out later on.
And he's like, I'm going to get her this time.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
hey, Dan, I hear you're good at crashing starships.
That's right. You know, and then he tweets it to her. The little text message pops up. Hey, Troy, why don't you do that thing that you're good at? You know, the crashing the ship thing. Make it so. but what I was going to say is that what Nemesis does really well here is that it gives you this realistic, large-scale feeling. If you were actually on these starships, you would have this large, grandiose feeling. When the scenes of the Enterprise-E and the Scimitar colliding, which were amazingly done partially anyway using models, which is pretty incredible because it's stuff that you know these days would be done completely CGI. You have this really big scale feel on the exterior, and then you have this interior shot of this just enormous landing bay, and you've got these tiny Riemanns running, and you've got this debris flying, and that kind of scale of destruction inside the ship is realistic, as opposed to what you often get, you know, like the shuttlecraft bays on the Enterprise and the Enterprise A in Star Trek V, for example, and even the shuttle bays on the Next Generation, which are way too small for what they must really be like in real life. So that and the battles encompassing the size of these ships is definitely something that Nemesis does well and probably better than any of the previous films or shows.
Yeah, really. Yeah, so that's really great. I think on the level of production design and editing and excitement, it's as good on those points as the 2009 film. What J.J. did well was, or what he was able to do, was have this reboot so he could bring new fans in. I do think Nemesis requires you on some level to know these characters already, to be invested in them.
Yeah.
But so for fans, I think we should be pretty happy about that, that we get this really high production value film that seems to be, at least on the script level, made for fans.
Yeah. I think on the script level, it was made for fans. I think on the shooting level, on the editing level, not completely. So as we kind of get towards the end of the discussion here, I've just a couple more things that I want to ask you about. And one of them relates to Nemesis and JJ and previous films, say like Insurrection. These Star Trek movies that are made for the general audience versus for the fans, is it good for Star Trek or not? Because like you said, you kind of have to know these characters to really get everything that's going to go on in Nemesis. And there are scenes that are that were shot that are on the extended cut. There's a two-disc DVD set of Nemesis that has these scenes in it. And they do fill in kind of a lot of the stuff that was missing. Like when you watch the movie and you're like, okay, how did they get here? And you know people are going off. You know people are leaving the ship. And this is, you know, Riker's going to go to the Titan and Beverly's going to go to Starfleet Medical. But these things are cut out. I guess two questions here. First, as if are these, would you rather have movies made for you as fans and have smaller box offices, or would you rather have these movies made for general audiences and try to pull fresh blood into the franchise that may or may not then go on to watch the series on DVD?
I think, I mean, not to not to cut the baby in half, but I think it's possible to do both at the same time. You know, a film like Star Trek IV was made for the fans, and it also managed to get huge, huge mainstream appeal. I think the problem with Nemesis is just that it came out at a time when people didn't really care about Star Trek, and it came out at a time when there were so many other films. You know, why have it come out in December when there's a Harry Potter movie and a Lord of the Rings movie? It's just going to get crowded out.
Yeah. Although you realize that it was actually on opening weekend beaten out by Made in Manhattan.
I know. It's painful. Painful.
I can understand, you know, the Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, you know, yeah, absolutely. I understand. And I often cite that for, you know, that it had some really, really stiff competition in that holiday release, but you know, Made in Manhattan, and then to set a record as the largest one-week drop in box office history until it was finally surpassed the following year by Geely is not a record that I like having, you know, in the Star Trek universe. Well,
it was a bad time for Star Trek, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it was.
96 was a high point in Star Trek. 86 was a high point in Star Trek. 2002, with Voyager petering out and Enterprise being on the horizon still, I just don't think that the public energy for Star Trek was there. And so I don't know what movie they could have released that would have been successful in 2002.
Yeah, it's a good
point. If they catered more to the fans, I just don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what it ultimately is, that even amongst the fan base, interest had waned to a point where they weren't going to get a First Contact type box office, because First Contact came out at the height of Star Trek. You know, I say the 90s were like the golden age of Star Trek, and I know TOS fans may differ with me in that opinion, but if you just look at from television to merchandising to novels to everything that was going on with Star Trek in the mid-90s, it really was a golden age. And by the time we got to 2000, it really had petered out, and the studio had kind of had gone to the well too many times, and Star Trek needed a break, and maybe that's what we see here. Okay, well, last thing in closing here, let's just talk about the very ending of the movie for just a minute. And there are a couple of things here. There is the data thing.
This movie had an ending?
Yeah.
I wasn't aware that there was an ending.
Well, that's the thing to talk about. Okay, there were two endings to this movie. There's the one that we saw on screen, and there's the one that was shot that was kind of designed to send Riker on his way to the Titan. I think there was a scene to send Beverly on her way back to Starfleet Medical. And there was, you know, bringing on a new first officer to take Riker's place. and then sending the Enterprise off on yet another new mission. So the story of the Enterprise-Z and Picard and all wasn't over. And of course, that got cut, and we got what we got, which was, I think, one of the worst endings that could have possibly been put on this movie.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, if you think about it, the film was focused on Patrick and Brent. Stuart Baird does know their names. And
you mean,
so to end
you mean
the film...
You mean Laverne wasn't in this scene?
I know. And Worf.
All right.
So to end the film on a scene with the two of them makes logical sense. Okay, it makes logical sense. The problem is it isn't a scene with Data. It's the scene with this B4 that we don't know and we don't really understand where that's going. And it doesn't give us the scenes we need. I mean, in the wedding, we find out that Data is going to be the new first officer. So when he dies, there's this question of who's going to be this new first officer. And so it makes a lot of sense. Just as in Generations, we had the scene talking about what's going to happen now that the Enterprise D has been destroyed. And they talk about it. It makes sense to have a scene that where we talk about what's next for the Enterprise. We also talk about Generations, how when you kill Kirk, you sort of kill off fans' imagination. They aren't able to imagine further adventures for him that might happen. And I think Nemesis does that in a way where it just ends very nebulously. Like, Data's gone. I think Riker's leaving, but I don't know where he's going. Is there even a first officer?
Yeah.
And that doesn't, you shouldn't leave your fans with such a weird, like, where's this going ending? And I think Stuart Baird just didn't realize he was leaving fans in a lurch in such a way.
Yeah, I don't think he realized it. It's everything from the scene after Data has been killed and they have wine and mm-hmm. Picard says to absent friends, and it's one of the best scenes in the movie for me, because mm-hmm. not only does it bring together this family of Next Generation crew, it's an homage to Kirk and the original mm-hmm. cast, because it's exactly what happened when Spock died.
Yeah,
Kirk
yeah.
gathered the crew and they have wine in his yeah. Apartment, and he says to absent friends, and it's totally mm-hmm. lost on Baird, because in Baird's commentary, all he talks about is the apparently famous Chateau Picard. Yeah. I mean, he had no idea that this was actually an homage to the original Star Trek. And I think that's all lost here. And like you said, there's, you know, we know that the crew is going their separate ways, and Riker finally has his command and all this stuff's going on, and it's just never addressed, and the film just ends. And it doesn't end on a scene with Patrick and Brent. It ends on a scene with Picard only. Yeah. I mean, B4 is not yeah. Data. It's not Brent. And if Data is going to have this sacrifice, and in Generations, you know, we talked about Picard having to come to terms with this idea of mortality, and here he loses mm-hmm. Data, and the scene with the wine is so touching. And you can see, I mean, God, Patrick Stewart's acting is so incredible. You can see on Picard's face, without him speaking any words, what this loss of Data means to Picard.
Yeah.
And then suddenly he's in his quarters talking to this B4 who's like Tweaky from Buck Rogers or something. You know, it's like, and then Picard leaves and he's walking down the corridor and he has this smile on his face like everything's okay now. And it makes no sense. And that's how it ends. And the only thing that salvages it slightly for me as a Star Trek fan is that the really, really final scene is the Enterprise in space dock over Earth as an homage to Star Trek the Motion Picture, because they pick up the theme. It's the same music that you saw with the original Enterprise refit in space dock. And then it goes. And I can't. It's just the wrong ending. It's the wrong ending for the movie. It's the
really
wrong
is.
Ending for the franchise, for the Next Generation send-off. It's just wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you can tell from the ending that they had that's on the deleted scenes, it's a good ending. Maybe it needed to be cut down. Maybe it's a little long.
Yeah,
but
it's long.
It was just a real send-off. And it's a It's just a pity that we didn't get a real ending to Next Gen.
Yeah.
You know, we got All Good Things, which is so good, but then the movies. And if you're going to have the movies, you need to have the movies have an ending that's at least as good as All Good Things, if not even better.
Yeah, it's like Enterprise didn't get an ending. It got you know, it got a Next Generation ending, and then here Next Generation didn't get an ending. So okay, well, I think we can agree that Nemesis is a pretty good film. It's not a bad Star Trek movie, unless you're really, really into some of the relationships and you wanted to see a real bit of closure for the characters that we spent a couple of decades with watching them on the screen.
I think a lot of like Troy Riker fans are happy that they got married. There's some relationship scenes. It's good, but it's not where it could be. It's not where it could be. And I think that's where Nemesis falls down in its lost potential. I think that's my main thought of Nemesis, that it could have been so much better.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. Well, those are our thoughts on Nemesis, Greg, anyway. And there's just so much that we could go on about here. And I had a bunch of things I wanted to hit on. But again, we're going to try not to talk for 2 hours. So we'll save some of the specific character stuff for some future shows. And we can, you know, like really talk about Data, for example.
Yeah, and I'd really love to talk about the Romulans, too. So hopefully we can get to that in a future podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Well, right until then, we would love to hear from the listeners and what they think about Nemesis. There's got to be some strong opinions out there about this movie one way or the other. And if you do want to share your thoughts with us on Nemesis, you can always send us a note by going to the website at trek.fm/contact. And you can leave us a voicemail by calling 646-652-TREK and let us know what you think. And of course, another great way to connect with us is through Twitter. We're always talking about Star Trek on Twitter, Greg and I both, through the Trek FM stream, and you can follow us at username Trek FM. And Greg, they can follow you on Twitter as well.
Right. So my personal account on Twitter is Greg Harbin. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N.
And you'll find me on Twitter at C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you'll also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And Greg, how's your Star Trek IQ doing these days?
It's not too bad. I think I have actually won the last two Trek FM Trek trivias, so I'm feeling pretty good about myself.
Great, great. Well, you can try your Trek trivia out as well. Just go to trek.fm/trektrivia for a multiple choice quiz. We do a new one every week. And also you can follow username Trek Trivia on Twitter, where Anthony Davis and Mark Stamper conduct live Star Trek quizzes a couple times a week. It's a great way to play Trek. And if you're lucky, not Shatner will show up. Well, Greg, it's time to put the wraps on another Ready Room.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's time to stick a doppelganger in it, because the Ready Room is done.